This podcast is brought to you by the Legatum Institute. I'm Sian Hansen, Executive Director, and we hope you enjoy this lecture.
I have the title Shakespeare on the Road to Freedom because it is part of this lecture series on the roads to freedom. Another title for this lecture could easily be, and indeed would in many ways be better to be, why is it that so many clever foreigners have got Shakespeare so completely wrong? And that's really, in a way, what I want to talk to you about tonight, if there's time and if you're tolerant. And the question I'd like to begin with is, did Shakespeare cause the fall of the Berlin Wall? As far as I know, it's a question that's never been set for an exam in an English school or university, though it's often been aired by modern historians. Shakespeare's popularity in the German Democratic Republic has been the subject of wide discussion among those who discuss the end of communism. Indeed, there's a book called Redefining Shakespeare, Literary Theory and Theatre Practice in the German Democratic Republic by Stephen Kelman, which is only one of many studies which suggests that Shakespeare was seen in the latter days of East Germany as a kind of secret agent, the patron saint of the dissidents. Hamlet was especially popular. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern were evident Stasi tools, hoods. And another writer, Emily Oliver, has written that a history of that famous production, that Berlin production of Hamlet, which began in August 89 and carried it through to March 1990, played a key role in the whole story. During this period, there were weekly anti-government demonstrations in the streets of East Berlin. Large numbers of people left Germany for Hungary. The government eventually resigned, and only days before the first performance of this Hamlet, the wall did indeed come down. And for the first time in decades, there were free elections in East Germany. The production was entitled Hamlet, Die Maschine, and it was directed by Heinrich Müller, and it was set inside a thawing ice cube, a symbol of the developing political climate. The ghost in Hamlet was Stalin. And at the end of the play, the savior of the collapsed Danish-German horror story was a representative of the Deutsche Bank called Fortinbras. During the period of the rehearsals, the actor Ulrich Mauer, who was playing Hamlet, addressed crowds of demonstrators. It's not surprising that in folklore, at least, something rotten in the state of East Germany came to be associated with the healing powers of the philosophical prince. Emily Oliver dismisses the idea that Hamlet brought down the wall, but it's easy to see, when we consider the history of Germany and the history of Shakespeare in Germany, why this particular piece of mythology has evolved. After all, the first language into which Shakespeare was translated was German. And even during his lifetime, he was extremely popular in Germany, with traveling players performing in the courts of the German princes. The first German translation of a Shakespearean play was in 1741, but it was a bit later in the 18th century with August Wilhelm Schlegel's translation of the complete works that we have the Germans, as it were, coming to possess and domesticate Shakespeare. It was a Schlegel version, for example, that Felix Mendelssohn knew when, at the age of 17, he wrote the incidental music to A Midsummer Night's Dream. Schlegel was a kind of uncle, I think, to Mendelssohn. And there were many other translations of Shakespeare into what Queen Victoria likes to call the dear German language. Indeed, her own husband, Prince Albert, translated passages of Shakespeare into German. And it was inevitable, I think, that when the scattered German lands looked round in the late 18th century for the birth of a great national genius who could unite the German-speaking peoples, less by the drafting of bills of rights or American constitutions than by an imaginative cohesion that the genius should have to see himself as a German Shakespeare. Goethe was barely 20 when he really discovered Shakespeare in Strasbourg at the bidding of his mentor, Johann Gottfried Herder. And it was under the influence of Shakespeare that Goethe wrote his first serious dramatic effort based on the life of the 16th century Franconian robber baron Gottfried von Berlichingen. This turgid work, supposedly inspired in technique by the Henry VI plays, wouldn't have been enough to guarantee its author immortality. But as a job application for national genius, it served its purpose anyway among Goethe's friends. Shakespeare, for this group of young men, was to be an escape vehicle, which would take Germany away, on the one hand, from the straitjacket of French classicism and French absolutism, and on the other hand, from Christianity, up into the bright, sunlit uplands of Goethean science and nature worship. In his very last days in Strasbourg as a young man, Goethe became attached to another law student called J.D. Salzmann, and together they formed a club which they called the Society of Beautiful Sciences, the Gesellschaft der Schönen Wissenschaften. And the most conspicuous event in the meetings of this club was a commemoration of the memory of Shakespeare. And they assembled with booze supplied by Goethe's father and sent over from Frankfurt, and with speeches to celebrate the British genius. Together with that other poet, they esteemed almost as highly Ossian. It antedated the exposure of Macpherson, the forger of Ossian, who, of course, in reality, was a poet whose works never actually had existed. In some ways, the Shakespeare idolized by these young Germans was equally phantasmagoric. For Goethe's generation, Shakespeare's importance was primarily that of an historian. They echoed the words of the great Duke of Marlborough: "Shakespeare is the only history of the past that I've ever read." Lost for a solution, as well they might be, for the future of those disparate lands that we now call Germany, but which in the closing decades of the 18th century were a chaos of different states, some aloof from and others held in thrall by the Holy Roman Empire. Language and culture were to be their political glue, more than direct political reforms. It's not clear to me how much Shakespeare, the young Goethe, had actually read. Nearly all the allusions in his autobiographical novel, Wilhelmmeister, are to Hamlet and Lear. But as his first biographer in any language, George Lewis, George Eliot's boyfriend, was to write, to the Germans, Shakespeare was a standard borne by all who combated against France. Goethe's speech about Shakespeare to his fellow Strasbourg enthusiasts declares, "The first page of his I read made me his for life, and when I finished a single play, I stood like one born blind on whom a miraculous hand bestows sight in a moment." In reaction to French formalism, whether in Corneille, Racine, or Voltaire, Goethe sees this crowd of chaotic characters natural. "I cry, nature, nature, nothing so natural as Shakespeare's men." Fascinatingly enough, even at this very early stage, however, Goethe was able to find in Shakespeare the ingredient which would inform his own Faust over a lifetime of composition. "What noble philosophers," he wrote, "have said of the world applies to Shakespeare, namely that what we call evil is only the other side and belongs as necessarily to its existence and to the whole as the torrid zone must burn and Lapland freeze in order that there may be a temperate region." If I've got time, and I put too much into this lecture, I do apologise, I want to return to this at the end. And Goethe's moral ambiguity and his wish to saddle Shakespeare with his own moral ambiguities. Certainly Goethe's opening of the door to Shakespeare in Germany practically tore the door from its hinges, with Sturm und Drang leading to a whole wave of German romantic drama without which modern literature really isn't imaginable. And if my subject was to be purely Shakespeare and Germany, which in some ways now I've reached the stage of the lecture, I'm wishing it had been, so I could happily settle down and we would just be talking about Schiller for the rest of the evening, because it's certainly in Schiller's plays that you see the full influence of Shakespeare. Richard Wagner, who's another very great Shakespearean, and he and his wife read Shakespeare to one another almost every evening of their lives, said that the play of Shakespeare's, which had really lit Schiller up and inspired him, I wonder if anyone in this room could guess it. I certainly wouldn't have done, and it leapt out of the page from the diary when I read it. Was Henry VIII. Strangely enough, as well as Wagner and Schiller, there are two other great writers for whom Henry VIII was the favourite Shakespeare play, and I expect you do remember them. One was Jane Austen, and the other was Beatrix Potter. But what I'd like to do, if I may, in the available time, is to puzzle out how it is that Shakespeare has inspired his European admirers and detractors, and secondly, to see if it really does make sense to include him in a lecture series on Rose to Freedom. But before I get there, I also, if I have the time, I may not have the time, I'd like to allude at least to his greatest detractor, in Europe anyway, Tolstoy, and Tolstoy's famous denunciations of Shakespeare. You probably remember that W.B. Yeats considered him and his friends to be the last romantics. But as far as the European romantics were concerned, there was no doubt who the first romantic was, and that was Shakespeare himself. And you only have to read Victor Hugo to see the truth of that. Hugo wrote in his book on Shakespeare, "It took 300 years for England to catch those two words that the whole world shouted in her ear, William Shakespeare." Hugo, whose short biography of the playwright precedes a long disquisition on the nature of genius, seems to have the most bizarre ideas about our national poet. He believed, for example, that Shakespeare's life was greatly embittered. "He lived," said Hugo, "perpetually slighted." This romantic view of Shakespeare has enjoyed some vogue in our own generation, with historians anxious to suggest that Shakespeare was either invented or summoned out of the air in the 18th century in order to provide us with a national genius when we were beginning to expand our empire. But this is really to overlook the prodigious fame which Shakespeare enjoyed from an early age and which is attested by the many tributes to him, prefacing, for example, the First Folio, compiled by those who acted with him, those who experienced at first hand not only his theatrical success, but his work on the plays. Shakespeare's success in the theatre, as an actor, as an impresario, and of course, above all, as the author of the plays, which all his friends and all his acting troupe knew him to be, explained the amassing of a huge fortune which enabled him to live at New Place in Stratford, as well as to own properties in London, the documentation of which, and the tenancy agreements of which, all exist for anybody to go and look at in the public record office, etc., etc. Hugo's belief that Shakespeare's posthumous reputation languished in obscurity until he was discovered by the French in the 19th century is bizarre, particularly when you consider the extreme popularity of Shakespeare. Immediately the theatres reopened. Think of the diaries of Samuel Pepys and his references constantly to attending plays by Shakespeare. Think of the 18th century and Dr. Johnson patiently reading and editing through his works. Think of the frequency with which Johnson's great pupil, David Garrick, reinterpreted all the great Shakespearean roles on the London stage. And when you think of the history of the English theatre, there isn't a single great actor, male or female, since the time of the Restoration to our own day, whose reputation has not been made by reinterpreting Shakespeare. At least, of course, Victor Hugo did not, as so many very foolish people do today, doubt Shakespeare's authorship of plays. But he does seem to have believed that Shakespeare lived in total obscurity. Whereas the truth is that although Shakespeare's personality remains opaque and secret, his fame and his success and his authorship of the plays are all matters of contemporary record. He was as famous in his own day as Laurence Olivier or Kenneth Branagh. Victor Hugo himself didn't actually read Shakespeare until the 1850s, but that didn't stop him, of course, writing what he considered to be the French equivalent of a great Shakespearean drama, and which was first performed in February 1830 at the Comédie Française. There is nothing like not reading Shakespeare for encouraging hero worship of Shakespeare. The Battle of Ernani. Ernani was the name of Hugo's play set in the Spanish 17th century. Happened on the 25th of February 1830, 4 months before the collapse of the Bourbon monarchy. But everybody who looked back upon that event in the theatre felt that it was the herald, the change, which was going to bring the autocratic restoration of the Bourbons to an end. Hugo's play deliberately broke all the rules of French classical drama. It even began with an enjambement, which was a matter of absolute horror for the purists. And by the end of his play, the sort of Hooray Henry types who'd attended it, knowing there was going to be a row, were dancing round the bust of Racine in the foyer of the theatre, shouting, "You've had your chips, mate," and all these other very French phrases. For Hugo, as a politician, this was his way of putting Shakespeare on the barricades. 34 years later, celebrating the tercentenary of Shakespeare's birth in 1864, Hugo's son, François Victor Hugo, published a complete translation of Shakespeare, and his father wrote this introduction, which I've already quoted from, which grew into a book. It was very much lampooned. Although it was entitled William Shakespeare, the first reviewer said it really should have been titled Moi-même, like probably most of the things that Victor Hugo wrote. There was a supposedly kindly review by Baudelaire, who said that, like all Victor Hugo's books, William Shakespeare was full of beauties and stupidities. Shakespeare is a socialist. He never realized it, but that is beside the point. Well, fast forward 70 years, in the same theater, in the Comédie Française, and the French had left behind the gentle-hearted, romantic socialist Shakespeare, and they are flooding in to see possibly the most stupendous Shakespearean production that was ever staged in Paris by the Swiss fascist actor-manager René-Louis Piachot. His version of Coriolanus, which he described himself as traduit librement, which was rather an understatement, was a stupendously ambitious production by any standards. It had a cast of 231 people on the stage, 92 Roman citizens, 30 Roman soldiers marching in and out, accompanying Volumnia whenever she made her exits and entrances. And the government was called upon to ban the production, which was described in the Chamber of Deputies as an adaptation to fascist étranger Piachot. In fact, although the legend afterwards was that it had been a consistently violent thing, the Piachot Coriolanus was popular and played on the whole peaceful houses. But the Action Française and the other extreme right-wing French groups wanted to use it as a propaganda tool. And sure enough, fisticuffs began, particularly towards the end of January 1934. So much so that the government moved in and made the rather peculiar decision to sack the director of the Comédie Française and put the head of the police in charge of the theatre. Rather as if Mr. Cameron were to make Sir Bernard Hogan Howe director of the National Theatre. He might make a slightly better job of that, who knows. Of course, all the people who were sitting there cheering on the Piachot Coriolanus were exactly the same people who watched with delighted rapture as their Champs-Élysées was marched down by the Wehrmacht 6 years later. Coriolanus has a strange stage history, never more so than in the troubled years before the Second World War. Between the years 1911 and 1920, it was performed far more often in Germany than it was in England. School editions of the play in the years 1933 to 45 reminded pupils that Coriolanus towered over, I quote, the falsely led people of false democracy, offering to lead them to a healthier society, such as Adolf Hitler in our day wishes to lead our beloved fatherland. When the Americans occupied the beloved fatherland in 1945, the play was banned. And indeed, its first post-war performance didn't take place until 1953, right up in Schleswig at the Neumark Landstheater. Meanwhile, and this is one of the weird things about these continental readings of Shakespeare, which I'm dwelling upon, in East Germany and in East Berlin, Bertolt Brecht's garbled version of Coriolanus, which my friend Paul Foote was very fond of and felt was the true Shakespeare. It was being performed by the Berliner Ensemble. In this version of the play, Rome comes to its senses, it learns to live without aristocracy or aristocratic leaders, and the tribunes take over a new, wonderful, Dave Spot popular order. When this was performed, the Brecht version, in Central Park in New York in 1965, it was the beginnings of the civil rights movement, hostility to the Vietnamese War and all the rest, it received an absolutely rapturous welcome. It's so strange for us to think of these people idolizing a Shakespeare whom an ordinary English reader or theatre goer would scarcely be able to recognize. Perhaps that's enough for the moment to think of the idolaters. What of the detractors? And of course, the great detractor, the greatest detractor of all of Shakespeare's genius was Lev Nikolaevich Tolstoy. Why did Tolstoy hate Shakespeare so much? It's one of those extraordinary questions. I think he disliked Shakespeare because of his lack of doctrinal absolutes. When you think of Tolstoy's most Shakespearean work, War and Peace, its author, when he'd finished it, or nearly finished it, had to, as it were, un-Shakespeare it and Tolstoy it up by all these sermons and disquisitions and Hegelian lectures on the meaning of history with which the novel concludes. Having allowed a whole gallery of characters, teenage girls, expectant mothers, peasants, old maids, emperors, generals, soldiers of the line, spivs, to be themselves, Tolstoy, as it were, appalled by what he'd done, tried to make the book into a sermon. What Goethe, as he expresses it in Wilhelmmeister, or what Keats, whom we're going to mention later at this time, both saw as the essential things about Shakespeare, our companion on the road to freedom, his ambiguity, his refusal to preach, stuck in the great Russian's throat. Unlike Hugo or the young Goethe, Tolstoy had actually read Shakespeare. He tells us he'd read his works in Russian, in English, and in German several times over, finding only in them what was insignificant and simply bad. His plays, as compositions, have absolutely nothing in common with art or poetry. They are works which are beneath criticism, insignificant, empty, immoral. Shakespeare is an insignificant, inartistic, and not only non-moral, but plainly immoral writer. Cyril G. Wilson Knight, and some of us still enjoy reading, was probably right when he said that Tolstoy was mainly reacting, though he didn't quite realize it, to all the commentators on Shakespeare, whose long, foggy, erudite articles he'd read with such displeasure. George Orwell's justly famous riposte to Tolstoy, which was entitled Lear, Tolstoy and the Fool, first published in March 1947, rather tellingly begins by saying that Tolstoy's essay on Shakespeare, originally published as a pamphlet in Russia, is, I quote, not even an easy document to get hold of in an English translation. I think this is telling because the essay was easily available in a small Oxford University Press volume entitled Recollections and Essays, translations of Tolstoy's minor prose by Aylmer Maude, and never out of print between its first publication in 1937 and the time that Orwell wrote his essay. Orwell must have read the essay in this version, but he writes about it as if he alone had found a rare old yellowing pamphlet, and he alone can stand up for our good old English genius against the Russian prig. Orwell very cunningly, as you will remember, I'm sure you know the essay, likened Tolstoy, the silly old fool with a white beard giving away his possessions, to King Lear. Ditto, 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 white beard. Lear gave up his kingdom. Tolstoy tried to renounce his estates, his possession of his copyright and so forth. But the deeper resemblance, Orwell wrote, lies in the fact that Tolstoy, like Lear, acted on mistaken motives and failed to get the results he hoped for. Orwell asked why Tolstoy singled out Lear with 30 or more plays to choose from. In fact, in the essay Shakespeare and the Drama, which is what Orwell is replying to, Tolstoy, while spending most of the essay on King Lear, it's true, also singles out other plays for attack. What about Othello? If he really suffered grief and remorse, then when intending to kill himself, he would not utter phrases about his own services, about a pearl, about his eyes dropping tears as fast as the Arabian trees, their medicinable gums. Hamlet, incidentally, he throws in for good measure, the chief character in the play has no character at all. Orwell even sees Lear's madness on the heath. Even the ending of his life, the sudden unplanned flight across country, this is the most thrilling bit of the Orwell essay, accompanied only by a faithful daughter, and the death in a cottage in a strange village, is an unconscious echo, of course, or prophecy of Tolstoy's own end. Orwell was every bit as opinionated as Tolstoy and was every bit as determined to cut a dash in the world. He wants us to believe that Tolstoy's adopting or adapting, whichever the right word would be, of Christianity would make him happy. And in fact, it made him unhappy. And the essay, Shakespeare and the Drama, is really an attempt to set up Tolstoyan Christianity against what Orwell calls Shakespeare's humanism. One of the things which Orwell's essay makes us ponder is Orwell's own journey, his own desire as an old Etonian to live as a hobo, to work as a plongeur in a Parisian restaurant, to walk to Wigan Pier and analyze the lives of the toilers. One of the things which Tolstoy hated about Shakespeare was his refusal to moralize. And Orwell sees this, understandably enough, as Tolstoy the Christian opposing Shakespeare, the Orwellian humanist. But the words Christian and humanist can mean more or less anything you want them to mean. And it may be that Orwell was so well equipped to denounce Tolstoy the moralizer because it takes one to know one. One of the things which Tolstoy very much disliked about Shakespeare, as I say, was this refusal to moralize. And what makes Orwell's essay so utterly fascinating is that he is more than half impressed, I think, by Tolstoy's boldness in denouncing a writer who, ever since the dawn of the Romantic Age, had been an idol. You can almost feel envy creeping through Orwell's words, as if, had Tolstoy not got there first, Orwell might well have had a go toppling Shakespeare from his throne. Nevertheless, in his defence of Shakespeare against Tolstoy, you feel, as so often, that Orwell's heart, insofar as he had one, was more or less in the right place. More or less. And he sees the fool's jokes and endless digs at Lear's high-minded folly in the same tradition that he viewed Donald McDougal's Seaside Postcards and Pubs and Boys' Comics. Yet even allowing characters to be themselves was arguably, I should say, just as Christian as it could be described as Orwellian or humanist. Why, all the souls that were forfeit once, till he that might advantage best have took found out the remedy. We can't speculate, it's vain to speculate, about what Shakespeare himself thought about anything, certainly about his personal beliefs, because his plays so profoundly concentrate on the personalities of others. They seem to leave no trace of the author. And yet, of course, any reader, for example, of Shakespeare's sonnets, who then turns back to the Henry IV plays, cannot fail to wonder what life story lies behind both works. On the one hand, and in both stories, you have an overweight, drunken, older man besotted with a cold-hearted younger man. Shake, spear, fall, staff. The tragedy of rejection, the ridiculousness of unconquerable sexual desire, the world of the Cheapside boarding house, which is also evoked so well in Measure for Measure, though it's set in Vienna, the dread of the clap, the power exercised by the ice-cold young man over the silly older man. They're all there, both in the sonnets and in the Henry IV plays, but in one work they are raw, hideously painful, and in the other they are transcendently comic. But we shall never know. And if we had been among the privileged circle who drank at the Mermaid with Ben Jonson and Shakespeare, we should probably see countless references to their gossip interwoven into these plays. Shakespeare, however, leaves no trace of himself, and he is to this degree as one whose name was writ in water. The words, of course, which were inscribed at his own request on John Keats's Roman grave. As we look back, 400 years since Shakespeare's death, we can see that Shakespeare lacked nearly all the qualities which so many of his European admirers and detractors so very much wanted him to possess. Shakespeare possessed with seemingly effortless abundance what Tolstoy had himself revealed himself to possess in War and Peace. Thinking of Dryden's commentary on the Canterbury Tales, God's plenty. Tolstoy managed the feat of recreating God's plenty without demonstrating a single glimmering of humour. There are characters in War and Peace that you can see would be funny if you met them. and would, if described by any other author, say funny things. But it's vain to wish writers other than they are. This, I think, is the factor in Tolstoy's makeup which most eloquently divides him from Shakespeare. Bottom the Weaver, Dogberry, Sir Andrew Aguecheek, the Porter in Macbeth, Lucian in Measure for Measure, Falstaff above all. They would be absolutely unimaginable to Tolstoy, incomprehensible. One thinks of Tolstoy's very, very great achievement, and if you've been to his room, his writing room, in Yasnaya Polyana, you see the portrait of Charles Dickens that he had hanging over his desk. And he read Dickens over and over again, and it is an extraordinary achievement to have read Dickens so often and with such sympathy, and not to have noticed that any of the novels were funny. Goethe, by contrast, tried to make Shakespeare what he himself was going to become when he eventually formed an idea of the two parts of Faust. He said, what noble philosophers have said of the world applies also to Shakespeare, namely, what we call evil is only the other side and belongs as necessarily to its existence and to the whole as the torrid zones burn Lapland freeze in order that there may be a temperate region. Is, though, this an anachronistic reading of any Renaissance writer? Isn't the truer reading not that Shakespeare was morally ambivalent, as that he was able to live with what Keats so superbly called negative capability? Those who've tried to make Shakespeare into an East German dissident, or into a Nazi, or into a communist, or into a French 19th century socialist, have all been trying to force him to toe the line. And this, to Tolstoy, is a disgust, was something which Shakespeare didn't seem able to do. Tolstoy, however, was surely just being simply obtuse not to see that Shakespeare's art, the prodigious range, the freedom of his characters, sprang from an imagination which allowed humanity to be itself. No one could witness the murder of Desdemona or of Lady Macbeth and her children. No one could sit through the humiliations of Timon and endorse Goethe's view that this playwright of ours sees evil as only the other side. No, there is evil in the world, all right. Shakespeare allows us to see it. Humanity, however, remains its chaotic mixture of good and evil. When Keats was 22, in, I think, December 1817, he wrote that wonderful letter to his brothers. He just seen Kean acting in Richard III. Edmund Kean was the great Shakespearean actor of his age. Like all great men, he sometimes fluffed his lines, certainly. If you're giving a speech, it's the sort of thing you'd most dread doing. You probably remember there was a famous production when Kean played Lear, and he was meant to say, how sharper than a serpent's tooth it is to have a thankless child, and he said, how sharper than a thankless tooth it is to have. Keats had just seen him playing in Lear, and he wrote to his brothers, several things dovetail in my mind, and at once it struck me what quality went to form a man of achievement, especially in literature, which Shakespeare possessed so enormously. I mean, negative capability. That is, when a man is capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason. Ideology masquerades as moral sense, but it invariably deceives its followers into something which is really the pursuit of power. Even in the case of Tolstoy, and even more the Tolstoyans, when he thought he'd recovered the essence of the gospel, and when he and his disciples believed themselves to have renounced power in their pursuit of anarchist pacifism, what they were really doing was trying to create or recreate rival orthodoxies to Christian orthodoxy. Goethe wanted, as did Hugo in a much cruder way, to see Shakespeare as the natural man. Nothing so natural. And it's there, all right, certainly. But Keats's Shakespeare is, to my mind, even closer to the authentic one, the one that we read, the one who we meet when we go to the theatre. Because Keats's Shakespeare will not be defined. Keats's letters drip with Shakespearean allusion, burn, as does his sonnet on King Lear, betwixt hell, torment, and impassioned play. The surrender of certainties for the truly great artist is not the surrender of principle. And that's really the core of what Keats saw about Shakespeare, and I believe is why Shakespeare is truly immortal, unlike so many of the Renaissance playwrights whom we read with fascination, but with antiquarian fascination, whereas Shakespeare always appears to be our contemporary. The end of East German communism, the demolition of the wall, were not, as was erroneously claimed at the time, the end of history. Perhaps, though, it was the end of a particular phase of history in which ideology was triumphant. It's no surprise that since the end of communism, we've also witnessed a sharp fall in the membership of all other political parties all over the free world, and a decline in active membership of churches. And nor is it a coincidence, I would submit, that in the same period, we've witnessed the most sublime renaissance in Shakespearean performances. Londoners have seen not only the fulfillment of Sam Wallet Major's dream of the building of the Globe Theatre, but also an almost continual Shakespearean festival, with some of the best Shakespearean acting, certainly in my lifetime, I've ever seen. Often highly traditional, often experimental. Shakespeare lived at a time of political and religious extremism, in which religious wars tore Europe apart, in which the unity and stability of Elizabethan and Jacobean Britain were threatened at all times by warring belief systems. He depicted emotional experiences across the whole range and gamut, except, and there's only one exception, except the religious. There are almost no people in Shakespeare's plays who explore the religious emotion. There are religious characters, like Isabella in Measure for Measure, but you hardly ever have a drama, as you might in a Dostoevsky novel, about somebody confronting their religion. The gods of pagan Lear and Cymbeline are as alive in these plays as Christ. So are the fairies. This doesn't make him anti-Christian. Rather, he depicted with godlike clarity and involvement the experience of humanity itself. And this enables us, as we stand in the rubble of our collapsed European ideologies, and as we don our crash helmets to avoid the crossfire between Islamic feuds and American involvement in the Middle East, to find in Shakespeare an immortal companion. His detachment seems less like cowardice, less like cynicism, than like wisdom. The passions which engage his characters, parental love, love between the sexes or between the same sex, patriotism, power mania, magic, and the sublime, are ones which surface whichever ideological insanity is gripping the world. He wrote his plays and his poems when European men and women were prepared to kill one another for a departure from the narrowest possible definitions of the Eucharist. We have watched him in the last hour, being read with passion in times of revolution, French revolutions, Russian revolutions. We've seen him embraced and hallooed by fascists, by communists, and by anti-communists. And during all that time, a broken-hearted Lear held his dead daughter in his arms. Prospero saw the vanity of power gains and the abuse of knowledge. Hamlet seems not only a more interesting, but a more abiding figure than the clear-cut, decisive figures of Fortinbras and Claudius. The willingness to live with mysteries, with doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason, is the boldest willingness of all. One which enables us, if we can begin to master it, to set out on the road to freedom. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much.
To hear more podcasts from the Legatum Institute, please visit our iTunes channel or website at www.li.com.